leave Gaza, to re-enter Gaza. But he managed. He got a scholarship to study, and he's now studying for a PhD in Mysore, India. And he's also quite fascinated by mapping projects, and it's a way of his own expression of resistance to war making. He is wanting to map the militarism in our world, and this leads to a wide array of map possibilities, in part because there is just so much militarism. But one of the things he has focused on is an interactive map, such that scholars, researchers, students, peace activists can learn more about any one of the over 800 US bases all around the planet, and find out, how many nuclear weapons are stored there, what's the possibility of decontamination from depleted uranium, how many soldiers are stationed there. And it gives a sense for the, I think, sinister infrastructure of militarism all around the world.
Well, yeah, and some of these maps, they feature mapping militarism at worldbeyondwar.org, and some of us may think of maps as something static, maybe on a wall or spinning on a globe on the table. These maps aren't those maps. These aren't your grandfather's maps, to steal a cliche, right?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I it's an educational resource that's, I think, extremely important in our world because, our capacity to eliminate life on the planet is always accelerating in the combination of ecological collapse, potentially nuclear weapon proliferation, and these various forever wars that seem to just spawn new spiraling rates of violence. So it's terribly important to learn how this militarism functions in our world and to try to label it and figure out ways to build grassroots resistance.
Well, yeah, and it's one thing to hear about the American bases around the world, the proliferation of them, more than 800. But to see them, now I'm looking at the website here, the No Bases Campaign website at World Beyond War. And in front of me, I've got a globe, and I can manipulate it with my mouse, tip the world up, down, sideways, and everything else, something I've always wanted to do. And what I see are like little pins in these maps, and I can just hover over them and get an idea. For example, where I just happen to stop right now is in Cyprus, and it gives me the type of base it is, the type of soldiers that the United States has in place there, and more information of the like.
Yeah, it's really quite a research project, and Muhammad Abu Nahel has been devoting himself to this many more hours than he's compensated for. And it is his passion in part because he realizes that when you ask, well, what's the justification for all of these bases? He believes that it has to do with dominance and control of resources. And that no one country ought to be able to dominate and control another country, as was his experience growing up in Gaza. So I hope that many, many people will promote usage of these maps. And there's quite a few additional maps in the Mapping Militarism project that can focus in on, where the drone attacks are happening and what countries have nuclear weapons and then, which countries are actually refusing to engage in war and are trying to promote a ban on nuclear weapons.
Well, and in the case of another one, the base in Djibouti, which is in the news now as American forces have moved from Djibouti into Sudan, that's in conflict right as we speak. But there's also links to other aspects of these military bases in situ, things like the effects that the base and all these man camps have on the communities around them, concerning sexual violence, prostitution, drugs, and other unwanted side effects, social side effects of having these bases in your community.
Well, that's certainly true. And also, a lot of times these bases spawn levels of corruption. We saw that happen in Afghanistan again and again and again. Once a base would be situated, then there's money coming from the base. Maybe they need to construct an airport near the base or construct a road. And so who are they going to hire to help with that construction? And very often in Afghanistan, the people who would come forward happened to be the warlords themselves, the Afghan warlords. And so there would be a new spiral of violence and control based on who was getting money to offer jobs or buy trucks or acquire weaponry. And then very often, the people who themselves were controlling little warlord networks would say to the people at the base, well, if you pay us, we'll protect you from people that might attack your trucks going in and out of the base. But it got to be a kind of a rope-a-dope sort of cycle, wherein the very people that were being paid for protection were actually some of the ones who were themselves wielding the weapons that could be used for attacks. And, you know, that's something people don't, I think, necessarily explore very much, the kinds of corruption that can come with the importation of weaponry and militarism into a country. And then I think, you know, it's also important when you think about Djibouti, there's one Chinese base in Djibouti, and it's sort of right next to the U.S. base, but that's the only foreign overseas base that China has. Not to say that China doesn't invest in militarism and growing militarism, but whereas we have, you know, well over 800 overseas bases, China has one, and our bases encircle China. And our nuclear weapons could be regarded as a threat to China, as could Russia's. And so how does the world map look when you're seeing it from a Chinese perspective? And what did the Chinese invest in instead of bases? Well, you know, they've perhaps made much more peace-building investments by investing in construction of roads and transportation and ways of helping people build a better life. And again, I don't want to say that the Chinese haven't exploited other countries or exploited their labor, but comparatively, you don't find that global infrastructure of military threat and preparation for war that's so representative of the United States.
Well, and that is dismissed in the West as just the Chinese being cunning and using soft power to get their hands on resources or throughways or for their own projects, and they're not doing anything really to help anyone. Is the usual mantra you'll hear coming from media on this side of the world.
Well, I don't think that's entirely fair, because it seems to me that the Chinese government probably does want to see a more multipolar world rather than a unipolar world, and would like to see itself as a mediator, as a broker for peace negotiations. But is that something to be scorned? I mean, I personally think there's a much better chance of ending the horrible, horrible war against Yemen if both sides, or all of the warring parties, let me say, start approaching a negotiating table. And the United States hasn't been able to accomplish that. But now you've got the Iranians opening up political channels of communication with the Saudis and vice versa. And I think that we will begin to see a lessening of the vicious fighting that's gone on within the Arab world. So I think that if China becomes a power, if you will, to balance some of what the United States has caused, but with its NATO alliance, for instance, and the insistence that every country all around the world should be fulfilling the U.S. interests in one way or another, perhaps that, you know, we will be able to reach a point where decisions aren't made based on who's got more weapon strength and who can accomplish more destruction and slaughter.
Yeah, it seems like a great big protection racket, and what's necessary to keep that protection racket going is the wars and the threat of wars. And in your article, you quote Muhammad Abu Nahal as saying that the threat is clear. If you don't submit yourself to fulfill U.S. national interests, the United States could eliminate you. And if you don't believe this, look at other countries that were surrounded by the U.S. bases. It's also a matter of these bases becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, yes, I think that when we look at the network of bases that was present in Afghanistan and then ask ourselves, so what did that accomplish? You know, after 20 years of drone attacks and night raids and imprisonments and torture, what was accomplished? Well, a lot of people went over to support for the Taliban because they were so enraged and angered and betrayed by the U.S. militarism. And you know, at the end of the day, in a very, very chaotic withdrawal, the United States left Afghanistan, and now people are facing hunger, and in the cold, harsh winter months, some were dying of hypothermia. The Taliban are in power. So what was the point of all those years of United States militarism and United States control?
Yes, well, some people did very well by it, of course. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Kathy Kelly. Kathy's a longtime peace and justice activist, essayist, author, and recipient of numerous awards for her peace service, as well as many nominations for the Peace Prize, the big Peace Prize, the Nobel. She's now sitting as board president at World Beyond War, where she's coordinating this November's Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal. That's, I think I spoke to someone else over there at World Beyond War about that a few months ago, Kathy. We're speaking today about her article, To End All Wars, Close All Bases. You include in your article a quote from David Vine's book, a play on the Field of Dreams, that build these bases and the wars will come. And with 800 bases around the world, it seems that America is prepared for wars for the next millennium.
Well, and I guess that question, who benefits, is actually so, so, so important, because there is a major beneficiary of every war, and that is the company that supplies the weapons. And that's why we're doing this Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal. Certainly governments should be held accountable, but what about the war profiteers? What about the companies that know how their products are going to be used? They've seen these products in use, maiming, killing, decapitating, displacing so many people in attacks that have targeted civilians. And there's just no question of restraining them, of inspecting what they do, of evaluating their products. And so that's what we want to do with the War Crimes Tribunal. We're particularly focusing on Boeing and Raytheon and Lockheed Martin and General Atomics, the company that manufactures the weaponized drones. And we want the evidence, the testimony before this tribunal to come as much as possible from people who've survived these attacks using the weapons. So people who grew up in Gaza, like Muhammad Abu Nahal, or people who can recall the attacks against their small villages in Afghanistan, attacks wherein, you know, a caravan of three buses packed with civilians was attacked by a U.S. drone and 21 people were killed. We want to hear from the people who, if they could, would want to claim reparations for the suffering and the sorrow that these kinds of attacks have caused. And so we're hoping that the tribunal will make recommendations, maybe about reparations, maybe about the possibility of people taking their cases to the courts and that's actually begun to happen now. There are some Yemenis who are suing because of the wrongful U.S. attack against their village. And then there is in Europe, there are a group of people taking a case to court in France, human rights groups. So there should be accountability on the part of the people who design and sell and prepared to use these weapons.
Yeah, it starts to get pretty murky now, too. We're moving into these, with the technology, into these automated weapons. Just this morning, I saw a video of a drone attack in Moscow. I'm looking at an article in our national paper, self-described The Globe and Mail up here in Canada, about what they term a tech entrepreneur, but he's a war tech entrepreneur, a Ukrainian national, but a Canadian now, who has set up simulators to teach people how to use these various high-tech weapons in the field. It seems to be outpacing us. In the introduction, I mentioned that this mapping technology being deployed by World Beyond War is something of a counterbalance to that. But in your article, you also talk about repurposing and converting former bases, as the Prime Minister in Spain is doing right now. Do you want to talk a little bit about spears into plowshares?
Well, it's certainly, from the point of view of defense, I think it's worthwhile to ask ourselves, okay, what do we really need to defend ourselves from? What really threatens us? And I think that ecological collapse is a threat. And how can we defend ourselves from ecological collapse? Well, we can start to create the means to recycle and to massively convert our infrastructure so that we use solar energy and wind energy and find ways to move ahead sensibly. And these bases could become instrumental in that effort. As ecological collapse looms and as wars rage, there will be more and more and more refugees. And bases could be used as ways to give humane treatment to people who are fleeing from economic or military or ecological deterioration of their societies. We certainly are at risk because of nuclear weapon proliferation. And if we removed all of the nuclear weapons stockpiled in these various bases, I think we'd be a lot safer. We would, our security would be greatly enhanced. And so the idea of the president of Spain taking some land that the military owned, the Department of Defense in Spain controlled this land, and saying, you know, what we really need is housing. We've got a housing crisis. Well, I think they're going to pay the Ministry of Defense for the land. It's not just being ceded, you know, to real estate companies, but it's an idea, I think, whose time ought to have come a long time ago. We can't afford these big, huge military infrastructures or the militarism that consumes so much energy and ingenuity and wealth in any country, and certainly within the United States. We have to think about a sort of a U-turn in which we start asking ourselves, okay, what threats are we really facing as we move into a real future? And not made up threats, believing that somehow China is our enemy and Russia is our great enemy. I think our great enemy is our own militarism.
Yeah, as you say in your article, Pedro Sanchez has announced at the end of April 20,000 homes for social housing on those lands owned by in the hands of the Ministry of Defense there in Spain. Do you think this signals a change of heart, at least in Spain, but maybe in other countries that are hosting the American bases too, where they're starting to think that, you know, they would maybe like to get out from the war-based business?
Well, again, I think that the development of other poles of political geopolitical power is worth looking at. If the United States isn't going to be the world's number one hegemon, and if there are other centers of power, and they're not so predicated on military control and networks of bases, then perhaps people will look for other ways to organize themselves that are more equitable and more fair. This is something I would hope for. But the reality in the United States is that it's not only the control over our elected officials that defense contractors have, but also there are so many companies that are dedicated to making parts for different kinds of military productions, or in some way tying jobs into this kind of network of militarism. The tentacles stretch into our communities in many, many ways. And so in a way, I think there's a big education task where we have to educate ourselves to see new possibilities and to recognize just how destructive our military has been.
Well, indeed, and you write in your article, it's a crucial first step that we get this fact-based education about the global infrastructure of America's military empire. But that goes too for within America, where there's plenty of bases and plenty of land controlled by the military, and also a great need for housing and a redirection of resources to help your domestic population in the United States, where the gaps, the income gaps and the life expectancy gaps and the social gaps are growing larger by the day.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. Congressman Adam Schiff actually was quoted yesterday in a webinar I was part of, saying that the Saudis have hired one lobbyist for each of every elected congressperson or senator in the United States. And the Saudis want to lobby U.S. elected officials to continue to supply the Saudis with weapons. And of course, that's good for business for Boeing and for Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and General Atomics. Well, how do the Saudis use these weapons? Well, they've bludgeoned Yemenis and prolonged a horrible war that's caused disease and displacement and a wreckage of the economy in Yemen. And that's just one instance of the way in which the push to dominate other systems by saying the military has to kind of trump all else is, I think, causing worldwide havoc.
Well, and I'm ashamed to say that Canada and the Canadian pension plan as well has profited by this. In the Yemen, they profited by selling arms to Saudi Arabia in its Yemen conflict, despite it being a violation of law here in Canada. But I'll let the lawyers deal with that sometime down the road. Could you reiterate, Kathy, how the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal will maybe give them an example to follow this November?
Well, we are going to do the entire tribunal online. So anybody anywhere in the world is very welcome to tune in. And we'll have jurists who are eminent legal people in the profession, but also some of the jurists will be people who, as I say, have survived these various attacks, and we'll have episodes focused on particular countries. We're working on the episode on Yemen and on Iraq and on Afghanistan and Gaza. And what we're hoping is that it'll be interesting for people to watch, and it'll be educational, and also it'll be archived, and it can be used by people in education efforts in the future or in other anti-war pursuits in the future. And the idea of a tribunal, of a people's tribunal, has a good history. Bertrand Russell convened a tribunal to challenge the United States war against Vietnam. And there have been various people's tribunals that have happened. I think it's a way for people in the grassroots to say, okay, this probably won't be dealt with in an official court of law. But that doesn't mean that there aren't issues of right and wrong to be examined and looked at carefully. So we'd love to see a Canadian Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal in the future as well.
Yeah, well, there's a lot to be answered for in this country, and it seems only to be going in the opposite direction for now, but maybe darkest before the dawn. Again, it's Kathy Kelly, and her article is To End All Wars, Close All Bases. You can find it at worldbeyondwar.org. Thanks a lot, Kathy, for coming on again and for all the work that you do now, that you continue to do and you have done for so many years.
Thank you, Chris. It's always good to talk with you.
And thanks to DeRosa Adaria. And please go and check out the work that they're doing over at openmedia.org. Thanks again, Kathy.
Bye-bye.
Back when Eisenhower was the president, golf courses is where most of his time was spent. So I never really listened to what the president said, because in general, I believed that the general was politically dead. But he always seemed to know when the muscles were about to be flexed, because I remember him saying something, mumbling something about a military-industrial complex. Americans no longer fight to keep their shores safe, just to keep the jobs going in the arms-making workplace. And then they pretend to be gripped by some sort of political reflex, but all they're doing is paying dues to the military-industrial complex. Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary. The military and the monetary get together whenever they think it's necessary. They turn our brothers and sisters into mercenaries. They are turning the planet to a cemetery. The military and the monetary use the media as intermediaries. They are determined to keep the citizens secondary. They make so many decisions that are arbitrary. We're marching behind the commander-in-chief, who was standing under a spotlight shaking like a leaf. But the ship of state had landed on an economic reef, so we knew he was going to bring us messages of grief. The military and the monetary were shielded by January and went storming into February. Brought us pot-bellied generals as luminaries. 2 weeks ago, I hadn't heard the sumbitch. Now, all of a sudden, he's legendary. They took the honor from the honorary. They took the dignity from the dignitaries. They took the secrets from the secretary, but they left the bitch an obituary. The military and the monetary, from thousands of miles away in a Saudi Arabian sanctuary, had us all scrambling for our dictionaries because we couldn't understand the fucking vocabulary. Yeah, there were some smart bombs, but there were some dumb ones as well. Scared the hell out of CNN in that Baghdad hotel. The military and the monetary, they get together whenever they think it's necessary. War in the desert sometimes sure is scary, but they beamed out the war to all their subsidiaries, tried to make so damn insane a worthy adversary, keeping the citizens secondary, scaring old folks into coronaries. The military and the monetary, from thousands of miles in the Saudi Arabian sanctuary, kept us all wondering if all of this was really truly necessary. We've got to work for peace. Peace ain't coming this way. If we only worked for peace, if everyone believed in peace the way they say they do, we'd have peace. The only thing wrong with peace is that you can't make no money from it. The military and the monetary, they get together whenever they think it's necessary. They've turned our brothers and sisters into mercenaries. They are turning the planet into a cemetery. We got to work for peace. Peace ain't coming this way. We should not allow ourselves to be misled by talk of entering a time of peace. Peace is not the absence of war, it is the absence of the rumors of war and the threats of war and the preparation for war. Peace is not the absence of war, it is a time when we will all bring ourselves closer to each other, closer to building a structure that is unique within ourselves, because we have finally come to peace within ourselves. Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary. Get together whenever they think it's necessary. They have turned our brothers and sisters into mercenaries. They are turning parts of the planet into a cemetery. what you gonna do? Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary. People say, what you gonna do? We hounded the Ayatollah religiously, bombed Libya, and killed Gaddafi's son hideously.